I started to see there were candle smoke drawings on the walls, as well as Chinese words. They were awful things. Coyotes with heads like spiders. Mountain lions with scorpions riding on their backs. Bats with heads like babies. I've wondered since then if I really saw those things, or if the air was so bad that far down in the shaft that I hallucinated them. I didn't ask Garen later on if he saw them. Maybe I didn't dare. He stopped and bent down and picked something up. It was a little black cowboy boot that had been wedged between two rocks. The tyke must have got it jammed and run right out of it. Mr. Garen held it up so I could see it in the light of my little flash, then stuck it in his shirt. We could still hear the la-la and the dum-da-da-dum, so we knew he was still up ahead. The sound seemed a little closer, but I wouldn't let myself hope. Underground, you can never tell. Sound carries funny. We went on, I don't know how far, but the ground kept sloping down and the air kept getting hotter. Had to have been at least a quarter of a mile from where the explosions cut into the shaft and opened it up, probably more. Just before my light picked out the little boy, he changed his tune. His dad told me after we got out that it was the Motor Cop's theme song. I only mention it because for a moment it sounded like someone else was singing the la-las and the dum-de-dums along with him, kind of harmonizing. I'm sure it was only that soft roaring sound I mentioned, but it gave me a hell of a bump. Garen heard it too. In the light from my flash, he looked almost as scared as I felt. The sweat was pouring down his face, and his shirt was stuck to his chest like with glue. Then he points and says, "I think I see him. I do see him. There he is, Seth!" He went running for him, stumbling over the rubble and rocking like a drunk, but somehow keeping his balance. All I could do was pray God he didn't fall into one of those old support balks. It had probably crumbled to powder just like the bones we'd stepped on to get where we were, and that would be all she wrote. Then I saw the kid, too. You couldn't very well mistake the jeans and the red t-shirt he was wearing. He was standing in front of the place where the shaft ended. You could tell it wasn't just another cave-in, because it was a smooth rock face, what we call a slide, and not piled-up rubble. There was a crack running down the middle of it, and for a minute I thought the kid was trying to work his way into it. When I got a little closer, I saw he was standing perfectly still. I must have been fooled by the shadows my little flashlight threw. That's all I can figure. His dad got to him first and pulled him into his arms. He had his face against the boy's chest, so he didn't see what I did, and I saw it only for a second. It wasn't just my eyes playing tricks on me that time. The boy was grinning, and it wasn't a nice grin either. The corners of his mouth looked like they were pulled most of the way up to his ears, and I could see all his teeth. His face was so stretched that his eyes looked like they were bulging right out of his head. Then his father held him back so he could give him a kiss, and that grin went away. "What did you think you were doing?" his father asks him. What he replied was the last real talking he did, and I remember it well. "Colonel Henry and Major Pike told me to," he said. "They told me I could see the Ponderosa. In there." He pointed at the crack, running down the middle of the slide. "But I couldn't. Ponderosa all gone." Then he laid his head down on his father's shoulder and closed his eyes, like he was all tuckered out. "Let's go back," I said. "I'll walk behind you and to your right, so I can shine the light on your footing. Don't linger, but don't run either. And for Christ's sake, try not to bump any of the jackstraws holding this place up." Now that we actually had the boy, that groaning in the ground seemed louder than ever, as if those balks were trying to tell us to get out while we still could. I couldn't resist shining my light into that crack once before we went, though. When I bent down, I could feel air rushing out. So it wasn't just a crack in the slide. There was some sort of rift on the other side of it, maybe a cave. The air coming out was as hot as air coming out of a furnace grate, and it stank something fierce. One whiff, and I held my breath so I wouldn't vomit. It was the old campfire smell, but 1,000 times heavier. I've racked my brains trying to think of how something that deep underground could smell so bad. Fresh air is the only thing that makes things stink like that, and that means some sort of vent. But the company has been burrowing in these parts ever since 1957, and if there had been a vent big enough to manufacture a stench like that, surely it would have been found and either plugged or followed to see where it went. The crack looked like a zigzag S or a lightning bolt, and there didn't seem like there was anything much in it to see, just a thickness of rock, at least 2 feet, maybe 3. But I did get the sense of space opening out on the other side, and there was that hot air whooshing out, too. I thought I maybe saw a bunch of red specks, like embers, dancing in there. But that must have been my imagination, because when I blinked, they were gone. I turned back to Garen and told him to move. "In a second, just give me a second," he says. He'd taken the boy's little black cowboy boot out of his shirt and was sliding it on his foot. It was the tenderest thing. All you'd ever need to know about a father's love was in the way he did that. "Okay," he says when he had it right, "let's go." "Right," I says. "Just try to keep your footing." It was a pretty awful walk, all in all. I kept looking ahead for daylight, and for the longest time I didn't see any. Then, when I finally did, it seemed like the sound of the hornfells was louder than ever, and I made up my mind that the shaft was going to wait until we were almost out, then fall on us like a hand swatting flies, as if a hole in the ground could think. But when you're actually in a spot like that, your imagination is apt to go haywire. Sounds carry funny. Ideas do, too. And I might as well say that I still have a few funny ideas about Rattlesnake Number One. I'm not going to say it was haunted, not even in a backstage report no one may ever read. I'm not, but I'm not going to say it wasn't either. After all, what place would be more likely to have ghosts than a mine full of dead men? But as to the other side of that slide of rock, if I actually did see something there, those dancing red lights, it wasn't ghosts. The last 100 feet were the hardest. It took everything I had in me not to just shove past Mr. Garen and sprint for it, and I could see on his face that he felt the same way. But we didn't, probably because we both knew we'd scare the rest of the family even worse if we came busting out in a panic. We walked out like men instead, Garen with his boy in his arms, fast asleep. That was our little scare. Later, I went to talk to Mr. Garen, who had staggered off to the powder magazine, which is a little metal shed where we keep our blasting stuff. He was sitting down with his back against the side. I helped him to his feet so we could back toward the others. We were most of the way there when he put his hand on my arm and stopped me. "You shouldn't let anybody go in there," he said. "Not even if the engineers say they can shore it up. There's something wrong in there." "I know there is," I said. "I felt it." I thought of the grin on the boy's face and almost told him that his boy had felt it too. Then I decided not to. What good would it have done? "If it were up to me," he said, "I'd toss a charge from your powder magazine in there and bring the whole thing down. It's a grave. Let the dead rest in it." "Not a bad idea," I said, and God must have thought so too, because he did it on his own not 2 weeks later. There was an explosion in there, not just a cave-in, but an explosion. And so far as I know, no cause ever assigned. "One thing I won't forget," Garen said, "is that Seth talked today. He actually talked. You don't know how amazing that is, but we do." He waved at his family, who had got back into the ATV by then. "And if he can do it once, he can do it again. And maybe he has, I hope so. I'd like to know, too. I'm curious about that boy, and in more ways than one." When I gave him his little action figure woman, he smiled at me and kissed my cheek. A sweet kiss, too, though I seemed to catch a little whiff of the mine on his skin, that campfire smell, like ashes and meat and cold coffee. I remember standing there at the bottom of the trailer steps, waving as they drove off toward the awful thing Garen's sister said was waiting for them at the end of their trip, a senseless drive-by shooting. All of them waved back. Except for Seth, that is. Whatever was in that mine, I think we were fortunate to get out. And for him to then be the only survivor of that shooting in San Jose, it's almost as if he's got what they call a charmed life, isn't it? Reading Audrey Weiler's letter reinforced my belief that something happened out there when Seth was under Hill. Something it might be wrong to lie about, but I did lie. How could I not? When I didn't even know what that something was. Still, that grin. That grin didn't seem to belong to the boy at all. I wish I could say better, but that's as close as I can come. I want to set down one more thing. I said that Seth talked about the old mine, but I didn't connect that with the rattlesnake shaft because hardly anyone in town knew about it, let alone through travelers from Ohio. Well, I started thinking about what he'd said again while I was standing there, watching the dust from their car settle. That, and how he ran across the office trailer, right to the pictures of the China Pit on the bulletin board, like he'd been there 1,000 times before, like he knew. I had an idea then, and that cold feeling came with it. I went back inside to look at the pictures, knowing it was the only way I could lay that feeling to rest. There were 6 in all, aerial photos the company had commissioned in the spring. I got the little magnifier off my keychain and ran it over them, one after another. My gut was rolling, telling me what I was going to see even before I saw it. The aerials were taken long before the blast pattern that uncovered the rattlesnake shaft, so there was no sign of it in them. But with my magnifying loop, I could see the prints his fingers had left on the shiny surface of the photos. Every one was on the south face, where we uncovered the shaft. That was what he wanted to see. Not the pit mine, but the shaft mine the pictures didn't even show. I know how crazy that must sound, but I have never doubted it. He knew it was there. It's like something in that mine sensed him going past on the highway and called out to him. And of all my questions, there's maybe only one that really matters. Is Seth Garen all right? I would write to Garen's sister and ask, have once or twice actually picked up a pen to do that. Then I remembered that I had lied, and a lie is hard for me to admit. Also, do I really want to prod a sleeping dog that might turn out to have big teeth? I don't think so, but there should be more to say, maybe, but there isn't. It all comes back to the grin. I don't like the way he grinned. This is my true statement of what happened. God, if I only knew what it was I saw. Old Doc was the first one over the Carver's back fence. He surprised them all by going up easily. To Brad Josephson, he looked like a skinny monkey in the moonlight. He dropped. There was a soft grunt from the other side of the stakes. You all right, Doc? Audrey asked.
Yeah, Billingsley said. Right as rain. Aren't I, Susie?
Sure, Susie Geller agreed nervously. What happened out there? Is everyone all right? My mom is having a cow, a large one.
Is everyone all right?
That was a question Brad didn't want to answer. No one else did either, from the look. Mrs. Reed? Johnny asked.
David next, then you? Cammy gave him her dry stare, then turned back to Dave. She murmured in his ear, stroking his hair. Dave listened with a troubled expression, then murmured back, just loud enough for Brad to hear, "I don't want to." She murmured again, more vehemently this time. Brad caught the words, "Your brother," near the end. This time, Dave reached up, grabbed the top of the fence, and swung himself smoothly over to the other side. Cammy went next, Audrey and Cynthia boosting. As she gained the top, Dave's hands rose to meet her. Cammy slipped into them, making no effort to keep hold of the fence for safety's sake. Brad had an idea that at this point, she might have actually welcomed a fall, maybe even a broken neck. "Why did you send us out here, Ma?" the kid had shouted, perhaps intuiting that his own eagerness to go and Jim's would never serve as a mitigating circumstance in her mind. Cammy would always blame herself, and he would probably always be willing to let her. "Brad?" That was a voice he was glad to hear, although he rarely heard it sound so soft and worried. "Are you there, hun?"
"I'm here, Bee."
"You okay?"
"Fine. Listen, Bee, and don't lose your cool. Jim Reed is dead. So's Intrajan from down the street."
There was a gasp, and then Susie Geller was screaming Jim's name over and over again. To Brad, who was emotionally as well as physically exhausted, those screams roused annoyance, and the fear that they might draw something worse than the big cat or the coyote. "Susie?" the alarmed voice of Kim Geller from the house. Then she was screaming, too, the sound cutting the moonlit air like a sharp whirling blade. "Susie! Susie!"
"Shut up," Johnny yelled. "Jesus, Kim, shut up!"
For a wonder she did, but the girl went on shrieking.
"Bee," Brad said through the fence, "shut that Chicken Little up. I don't care how."
"Jim!"
Susie screamed.
"Jim! Oh, God, no! Oh!"
There was a slap. The screams were cut off almost at once. Then,
"You can't hit my daughter, you bitch. I don't care what ideas you've gotten from affirmative action, you fat black bitch."
"Oh, fuck me till I cry," Cynthia said. She squeezed her eyes shut like a kid who doesn't want to watch the last minutes of a scary movie. Brad held his breath, waiting for Bee to go nuclear. Instead, Bee ignored her, calling softly through the fence.
"Are you sending his body over, Bradley?"
She sounded completely composed, for which Brad was completely thankful.
"Yeah. You and his mother and his brother catch hold of him when we do."
Then the coyotes began to howl again. Brad looked over his shoulder and saw chips of moving silver light in the tangled darkness of the green belt.
Eyes.
"We've got to hurry," Cynthia said. "You don't know the half of it," Audrey said. They raised the body like a quartet doing a team bench lift. For one horrible moment, Brad thought his back, having supported a shamefully large gut for the last 10 years or so, was going to lock up. Then they had Jim's body up to the top of the fence. The dead boy's arms hung out to either side, his open palms full of moonlight. Beside Brad, Johnny sounded on the verge of cardiac arrest.
"Help us," Cynthia gasped. "For Christ's sake, somebody!"
Hands hovered above the blunt fence stakes for a moment, then broke apart into fingers which grasped Jim's shirt and the waistband of his shorts. Just as Brad knew he couldn't hold the body another second, it was pulled away from him. There was a meaty thud, and then from a little distance away, Susie Geller voiced another brief scream.
"Sounds like they dropped him," Johnny said in a low voice.
"Whoops,"
Brad said.
"Yeah, whoops a fucking daisy."
Cynthia, Audrey, then Steve went next. Then it was Johnny and Brad's turn.
"I can't get over there," Johnny said. "No way."
"Woo, woo, woo!"
From almost directly behind them, the two men jumped into each other's arms as unself-consciously as small children. Brad turned his head and saw shapes closing in.
Each was hulked up behind a pair of those glinting, semicircular moon ships.
Cynthia, Johnny shouted, shoot the gun.
When her voice came back, it sounded scared and uncertain. You mean come back over the...
No, just shoot it into the sky.
She triggered the 30-06 twice, the blasts whip-cracking the air. The bitter tang of gun smoke seeped through the fence stakes. The shapes coming toward them through the green belt paused. Didn't draw back, but at least paused.
You still poop, John?
Brad asked softly. Johnny was looking back at the shapes in the shadows. There was a strange, shaky smile on his mouth. Nah, he said.
Got my second wind.
What do you think you're doing?
What does it look like? Brad asked.
He was down on his hands and knees at the base of the fence.
Hurry up, Daddy-o.
Johnny stepped onto his back. Jesus, he said. I feel like the president of South Africa. Brad didn't seem to understand at first. When he did, he began giggling. His back hurt like hell. Johnny Marinville seemed to weigh at least 500 pounds. The man's heels felt as if they were leaving divots in Brad's outraged spine. But the giggles poured out of him just the same. He couldn't help it. Here was a white American intellectual with a prep school education of excruciating correctness. A writer who had once partied with the Panthers at Lenny Bernstein's pad, using a black man as a footstool. If it wasn't a liberal's idea of hell, Brad had never heard of one. He thought of moaning and crying, "Hurry up, massa, you killing this poor boy." And his giggles became outright laughter. He was terrified of losing a section of his tender, upturned ass to one of the slinkers back there in the woods, but he laughed anyway. "I'll give him a chorus of Old Black Joe," he thought, and he howled like a coyote himself. Tears poured from his eyes. He pounded his fist on the ground.
"Brad, what's wrong?"
Johnny whispered from above him.
"Never mind," he said, still giggling. "Just get off my back. Holy shit, what do you got on those shoes? Cleats?"
Then, blessedly, the weight was gone. There were grunting sounds as Johnny struggled to get his leg over the fence. Brad got up, rode through another scary moment when his back seemed about to lock, then got one meaty shoulder planted under Johnny's ass. A moment later, he could hear another grunt of effort and a muffled cry from Johnny as he came down, which left him all alone and with no footstool. Brad eyed the top of the fence and thought it looked about 90 feet high. Then he glanced behind him and saw the shapes on the move again, tightening around him in a collapsing crescent. He seized two of the stakes, and as he did, something snarled behind him. Underbrush rattled. He looked back over his shoulder and saw a creature that looked more like a wild boar than a coyote, except what it really looked like was a badly made child's drawing. Nothing more than a hurried scribble, really, that had somehow come to life. Its legs were all of different lengths and ended in blunt clubs unlike either paws or fingers. Its tail seemed to jut up from the middle of its back. Its nose was a pig pug. Only its teeth seemed really real. Huge, croggled things which spouted from either side of the beast's mouth. Adrenaline hit Brad's nervous system and he forgot all about his back, yanking himself upward, tucking his knees between his chest and the fence when he heard the thing charge. It hit just below his feet, hard enough to shake the whole fence. Then Johnny had one of his wrists and Dave Reed had the other, and Brad scrabbled to the top of the fence, leaving generous amounts of skin behind. He tried to get his left leg over the top and thumped the ankle on one of the blunt stakes instead. Then he was falling, tearing his shirt all the way down one side in his useless struggle to hold onto the top. He let go in time to keep from breaking his arm, but when he landed, partly on top of Johnny, mostly on top of his admirably padded wife, he could feel blood trickling down from his armpit.
"You want to get off me, handsome?" the lady herself asked, sounding breathless. "I mean, if it wouldn't discommode you any."
Brad crawled off them, collapsed in a heap, then rolled over on his back. He looked up at alien stars, swollen things that blinked on and off like Christmas lights. What he was looking at were no more real stars than he was the king of Prussia, but they were up there just the same. How bad was your situation when the sky itself was part of the damn conspiracy? He closed his eyes so he wouldn't look at them anymore. Brad, Johnny said, low voice, leaning over him from the sound. What? Still not opening his eyes.
I had an idea for a movie.
You're a maniac, John.
Eyes still shut. Things were better that way.
But I'll bite. What's it gonna be called?
Black Man Can't Climb Fences, Johnny said, and began laughing wildly. It had an exhausted, half-crazy sound to it.
I'm gonna get Mario fucking Van Peebles to direct. Larry Fishburne's gonna play you. Sure, Brad said, sitting up painfully. I love Larry Fishburne. Very intense. Offer him $1 million up front. Who could resist? Right, right, Johnny agreed, now laughing so hard he could barely talk. Only tears were streaming down his face, and Brad didn't think they were tears of laughter. Not 10 minutes ago, Cammy Reed had come within a hair of blowing his head off, and Brad doubted if Johnny had forgotten that. Brad doubted if Johnny forgot much of anything, in fact. It was probably a talent he would have traded, if given the opportunity. The thing hopping unsteadily through the gate into Tom Billingsley's backyard was a child's version of the Gila monster Jeb Murdoch blows off a rock during his shooting contest with Candy, halfway through the regulators. Its head, however, was that of an escapee from Jurassic Park. It hopped up the back steps, slithered to the screen, and pushed at it with its snout. Nothing happened. The screen opened outward. The Gila stretched its saurian head forward and began chomping at the bottom panel of the door with its teeth. 3 bites was all it took, and then it was in old Doc's kitchen. Gary Sauderson became distantly aware of a rotten breeze blowing into his face. He raised one hand, touched something that felt like an alligator shoe, and opened his eyes. What he saw leaning over him at kissing distance was so grotesque that he could not even scream. He closed his eyes. He tried to tell himself that he didn't smell swamp breath or hear the toneless clickety-click of a tail dragging across the kitchen linoleum. He held his dead wife's cold hand. He said, "Nothing there. Nothing there. Nothing." Before he could finish, the monster had plunged its teeth into his throat and torn it open. Johnny saw small feet through the open pantry door and looked in. Ellie and Ralphie were fast asleep, holding each other, their faces white and strained even in slumber. Ellen must have found a futon and brought it into the pantry for herself and her little brother to lie on. Certainly Kim Geller hadn't done it. Kim and her daughter had resumed their former places by the wall, only now in kitchen chairs instead of on the floor.
"Is Jim really dead?"
Susie asked, looking at Johnny with wet, shiny eyes as he came in behind Brad and Belinda.
"We were going out to the movies tonight."
Johnny was completely out of patience with her. "Why don't you go out back and look for yourself?"
"Why are you being such a bastard?" Kim asked angrily. "My daughter may never get over a serious trauma like this. She's had a profound shock."
"She's not the only one," Johnny said, "and while we're at it..." "Quit it, man. We don't need to get fighting," Steve Ames said. Undoubtedly true, but Johnny no longer cared. He pointed a finger at Kim, who stared back with hot, resentful eyes. "And while we're at it, the next time you call Belinda Josephson a black bitch, I'll knock your teeth down your throat."
"Stop it, John," Belinda said and took his arm.
"Fat black bitch,"
Kim Geller said, looking at Johnny with burning eyes and the most poisonous smile he had ever seen in his life. Fat, black, nigger, bitch. She pointed her own finger at her mouth and visible teeth. Her daughter looked on with a stunned expression. Okay? So come on. Knock my teeth down my throat. Johnny started forward. Brad grabbed one of his arms. Steve grabbed the other one.
Get out of here, you idiot,
old Doc said. His voice was harsh and dry. Kim rose from her chair, pulling Susie out of hers. For a moment, it seemed they would go into the living room together, but then Susie pulled away. Kim reached for her, but Susie backed off. Not me, Susie said, shaking her head. Kim stared at her, then looked back at Johnny. Her face was sick with a kind of hateful confusion. Susie turned her back on her mother, trembling all over. All right, Kim said. When you want me, I'll be in the living room. Her eyes switched to Johnny, whom she seemed to have identified as the source of all her misery. And you, stop it, Audrey said harshly. Startled, they all turned to look at her, except for Kim, who slipped off into the dark. If you fools stand around squabbling, all we're going to do is die.
Who are you, ma'am? Steve asked.
Audrey Weiler. She was tall, her legs long and coltish, and not unsexy below her blue shorts. But her face was pale and haggard. It made Johnny wonder when he'd last seen Audrey pass the time of day with her. He couldn't. It was as if she had dropped out of the casual back-and-forth life of the street entirely.
Little bitty baby Smitty, he thought suddenly. I seen you bite your mommy's titty.
Then he thought of the Vans that had been on the floor of the Weiler den that afternoon he'd watched Bonanza with Seth. A kind of landslide started in his head. Outlaws that looked like movie stars, Major Pike, a good alien gone bad, the western scenery. He loves old westerns, Audrey had said that day. Bonanza and the Rifleman are his favorites, but anything they'll bring back on the cable, he'll watch.
It's your nephew, Audrey, isn't it?
No, not Seth. What's inside Seth? Audrey said. And if the thing doing this caught the energy from the people who died out there in the woods, the next run will be the worst yet. She drew in a deep breath. The thing inside Seth is named Tok.
Is it a demon, Aud? Old Doc asked. Some kind of demon?
It's more like a tumor, I think, that's conscious and enjoys cruelty and violence. It's been inside him for almost 2 years. It called Seth when he and his family were crossing the Nevada desert. It sensed someone it could use, passing by, and called him. She looked down at her hands, which were knotted tightly together in her lap. Kim Geller was standing in the living room doorway now, drawn by Audrey's story. Audrey looked up again. She spoke to them all, but it was Johnny her eyes kept returning to. I think it was weak at first, but not too weak to understand that Seth's family posed a threat to it. I don't know how much they knew or suspected, but I do know that my last phone conversation with my brother was very strange. I think Bill could have told me a lot, if Tok had let him.
It can do that? Steve asked. Impose control?
She gestured at her swollen mouth. My hand did this, she said, but I wasn't running it.
Christ, Cynthia said.
She looked nervously at the knives hanging on their magnetized steel runners over the kitchen counter.
That's bad.
It could be worse, though, Audrey said. Tok can only physically control it usually no more than 20 or 30 feet. Beyond that, its physical influence runs out in a hurry, usually. Now, all bets are off, because it's never been so loaded with energy. Johnny could feel time almost as a tangible thing slipping away from them. He didn't know if he was getting that from Audrey, or if it was coming from inside himself, and he didn't care. Time was short. He had never felt an intuition so strongly in his whole life.
It's a vampire, isn't it? Johnny said.
Only what it draws off is psychic energy instead of blood. She nodded. and the energy it uses is most abundantly available when someone is in pain. In the case of Bill and the rest of his family, maybe someone in the neighborhood died or was hurt, or maybe there was a handy bum, Steve said. I bet he died with a smile on his face. Audrey looked at him, her face sad and sickened. You know?
Not much, but what I know fits what you're saying, Steve told her. There's a guy like that back there.
Audrey was looking away from them now, nibbling at lips that looked dry and sore. Herb and I took him in. And in some ways, in many ways, actually, I was never sorry. We could never have children ourselves. He was a loving boy, a sweetheart of a boy.
Herb didn't kill himself, did he? Tom asked. This talk thing murdered him.
She nodded again. Herb wanted us to get away from it. Talk sensed that, and it found it couldn't use Herb for something it wanted to do. To have sex, experience sex with me, Herb wouldn't let it. That made Tuck angry.
My God, Brad said.
It killed Herb and replenished itself. After that, Seth was its only hostage. But Seth was all it needed to keep me in line.
Because you love him, Johnny said.
Yes, that's right, because I love him. It wasn't defiance Johnny heard in her voice, but a weird, awful shame. She turned her streaming eyes toward Cammie Reed, who sat on the floor with her arm around her remaining son. I never believed it would come to this. You have to believe that. Even after it drove the Hobarts away and killed Herb, I had no idea of what its powers could be.
Cammie looked at her, giving nothing out of her stone of a face.
All that time, Tuck was inside, growing, pushing its roots deeper and deeper, invading him.
And you didn't know any of this was going on, Kim asked from the doorway. Oh, wait, I forgot. It killed your husband, but you just passed that off, didn't you? Probably as an...
You don't understand, Audrey nearly screamed. You don't know what it was to live with him, and with it inside him. It would be Seth. And then I might have a thought that I didn't shield well enough, and I'd find myself running into a wall over and over again. I can't tell you what it's like, how horrible it is. Like being a passenger in a car that's being driven by a maniac.
She stopped, almost visibly catching hold of herself, settling herself down.
This nightmare we're in is a combination of The Regulators, his favorite Western movie, and MotoCops 2200. His favorite cartoon show. One episode in particular, the one about the Force Corridor. It's very, very scary for a cartoon show, very intense. Seth was terrified of it. He wet the bed 3 nights in a row after seeing it for the first time, but he was also exhilarated, mostly because the way the show's continuing characters, both good and bad, band together in order to destroy the scary aliens hiding in the Force Corridor. These aliens are in cocoons Colonel Henry first mistakes for power generators, and the part where they come bursting out and attack the Moto Cops would scare just about anybody. Only I think that in this telling of the Force Corridor, the cocoons are our houses, and we're
the scary aliens, Johnny said. He nodded. It all made horribly perfect sense, and I suppose what appeals most to both parts of him, or it, is the forced cooperation.
Audrey was nodding, too.
Forced cooperation. Yes, that sounds right. Like how the characters from The Regulators, good and bad, have always gotten along with the Moto Cops in Seth Sandbox's play fantasies. In his fantasies, even Sheriff Streeter and Jeb Murdoch get along, although they're deadly enemies in the movie.
Is what's happening now still a fantasy? Johnny asked.
I can't really tell, she said, because it's hard to know where Tuck leaves off and Seth begins. You have to kind of feel for that point. I mean, on some level, he probably knows better, but we hate to give up some of those make-believes, don't we?
She broke off for a moment. Her lower lip trembled, then firmed again. There's a sweetness to the best of them. Something that helps us get over the rough spots. Tak has allowed Seth to play out his fantasies on a wider screen than most of us get, that's all.
Hell, he's getting to play them out in virtual reality, Steve said. That's what you're describing.
The ultimate virtual reality game. There's another possibility, Audrey said. Seth may not be able to stop Tak anymore, or even put a brake on it. Tak may have tied Seth up, gagged him, and thrown him in a closet.
But what does Tak get out of it? Johnny asked.
Something all his own, Audrey said. The fantasies were always strictly for Seth, I think. They're the way Tak taps into Seth's powers, which complement its own. I think Tak just likes what happens to us.
Silence in the room. Likes it, Belinda said at last. She spoke in a low, considering tone. What do you mean, likes it?
When we hurt. We give something off when we hurt. Something it licks up, like ice cream. When we die, that's even better. It can just gobble the stuff down whole. So we're dinner, Cynthia said. That's what you're saying, right? To Seth, we're a video game, and to this Tak, we're dinner.
We're more, Audrey said.
Tak is making. That's what Seth told me, and building. I don't think the desert where Seth picked it up was its home. I think that was its prison. Its home is what it may ultimately try to recreate here.
On the basis of what I've seen so far, I don't even want to visit its neighborhood, let alone live there, Steve said. In fact,
quit it,
Cammy said. Her voice was harsh and impatient. How do we kill him? You said there might be a way.
Audrey looked at her, shocked.
You're not killing Seth, she said. No one is killing Seth.
You can get that thought right out of your mind. He's just a harmless little boy.
Cammy leapt at her and grabbed her shoulders. It was done before Johnny could even think of moving. Her thumbs sank deeply into the tops of Audrey's breasts.
Tell it to Jimmy,
she shouted into Audrey's stunned face.
He's dead, so don't you go crying to me about how harmless your nephew is. That thing is in him like a tapeworm, and if it won't come out...
But it will,
Audrey said. She began to regain control of herself, and her voice grew calm again.
It will.
Cammy relaxed her grip slowly, and her look was not trusting.
How?
When? Before Audrey could reply, Kim said, I hear a humming sound, like electric motors. Her voice rose, trembling.
Oh, God, they're coming back.
Now Johnny could hear it, too. He looked toward the cellar door and decided it was probably too late to try for the basement, especially with two sleeping children in the pantry.
Down, he said. Everyone down on the floor.
He saw Cynthia take Steve's hand and point through the open pantry door with a finger which wasn't quite steady. Steve nodded and they went in to cover the children's bodies with their own. The humming swelled.
Pray, Belinda said suddenly. Everybody pray.
Johnny was too frightened to pray. From Audrey Weiler's journal, February 7th, 1996. Have noticed something interesting. What may be a key way of deciding which of them is in charge at any given time of the body they share. They both care a great deal for the Cassandra Stiles action figure, but Tak's caring is almost completely sexual. It strokes her plastic breasts and rubs her plastic legs. 2 days ago, I saw it sitting on the stairs and licking the crotch of her blue shorts and sporting a full erection. And of course, the fact that it wants me to wear Cassie-type clothes and has gotten me to dye my hair Cassie Styles red has not escaped me. Seth, on the other hand, when it's Seth, sometimes he just hugs the figure of Cassie or strokes its stiff red hair or kisses its cheek. He's pretending... It's his mother. I don't know how I know that, but I do. Must stop now. Crying again.